On the 24th of February 1791, only a week before he died, Reverend John Wesley wrote his last letter. It was to William Wilberforce about Wilberforce's early struggles against the slave trade. "Dear Sir, unless the divine power has raised you up to be as Athanasius contra mundum, I see not how you can go through your glorious enterprise in opposing that execrable villainy which is the scandal of religion, of England, and of human nature. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. Reading this morning a tract wrote by a poor African, I was particularly struck by that circumstance that a man who has a black skin, being wronged or outraged by a white man, can have no redress. What villainy is this? That he who has guided you from youth up may continue to strengthen you in this and all things is the prayer of, dear sir, your affectionate servant, John Wesley." Wilberforce would need the encouragement. For 2 months later, his first parliamentary motion for abolition would be defeated. It would be 16 long years before Britain abolished the slave trade. When Wilberforce received Wesley's letter, the Clapham sect was a year away from existing as a self-conscious group, although Wilberforce often visited his friends at Clapham, then a pleasant village 3 miles southwest of London. Clapham would become a key location, and the sect would have other important meeting places. However, its endeavours would not just be Clapham-centred, but international and far-reaching in scope. We need to note here that the word sect is misleading. It was not a sect as we use the term today. The group mostly comprised loyal Anglicans and was decidedly evangelical. But it did include, for example, the MP William Smith. Although a Unitarian, Smith was a zealous advocate of abolition and other philanthropic causes. Indeed, the Clapham sect was prepared, where necessary, to make common cause in the political arena with free-thinking radicals and utilitarians, many of whom detested the slave trade. Then again, Clapham sect was not a term the sect itself would have recognised. The contemporary, somewhat derisory label was saints. The phrase Clapham sect originated a generation later in 1844 through Sir James Stephen's well-known essay, whereas the sect's endeavours had been from 1792 to 1815. I prefer and will mainly use the phrase Clapham group in this paper. Wesley's letter to Wilberforce asserted at least two things. First, that the slave trade was execrable, which means abominable or detestable villainy, and second, that it would be hard to stop. Neither assertion was the least exaggerated. Consider first the trade's villainy. Britain's slave trading began in 1562, with Sir John Hawkins transporting 300 slaves, some captured from Portuguese slave ships, from West Africa across the Atlantic to Hispaniola. Over the next two centuries, as a result of the Sugar Revolution, slave trading with the Caribbean expanded greatly. For example, by the 1770s, 84% of enslaved Africans in Jamaica were working on sugar plantations. Barbados and Jamaica were the main islands for growing sugar cane, followed by the Leeward Island settlements of Antigua, St. Christopher, Nevis, and Montserrat. Liverpool, London and Bristol were Britain's main slaving ports. 1771 saw 100 ships leave Liverpool on slaving voyages, compared with 58 from London and 20 from Bristol. The number of slaves transported was enormous by any count. William Wilberforce estimated that in 1789 alone, Britain transported 38,000 slaves. By 1807, between 2 and 3 million African slaves had been transported on British ships to the Caribbean. Dr. Robert Oliver has described how the triangular trade worked. Quote, by the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713, Britain secured from the French and Spaniards a virtual monopoly of the Atlantic slave trade. At the same time, she contracted to supply the Spanish West Indies with 144,000 slaves within 30 years. The traders left Britain with woolens, cotton goods, trinkets, guns, and gunpowder. These were traded on the African coast for slaves, often supplied by the Africans themselves as a result of tribal warfare. These slaves were then shipped on the Middle Passage across the Atlantic to the West Indies, the southern British colonies on the mainland, and to the extensive South American empires of Spain and Portugal. American goods were then shipped back for sale in Britain and Europe. Usually these were commodities such as sugar, cotton and timber, but they could include men, women and children. Close the quote. The Middle Passage took 3 weeks to several months, depending on wind and weather. At its height, ships were crammed with 400 to 900 slaves, guarded by perhaps a few dozen sailors. Captives were chained in pairs to plank beds or the ship's timbers, and were often so tightly packed that they were forced to lie down amidst their own and other slaves' excreta, blood and vomit. Little wonder that disease prevailed, especially if the passage was lengthened and made more miserable by bad weather. The death toll was 10 to 45% before they were ever offloaded and auctioned at the other end. Death rates were high among the seamen who guarded them. Thomas Clarkson calculated that in 1786, out of 5,000 sailors on the triangular route, 2,320 came home, 1,130 died, and 1,550 were discharged, deserted, or otherwise unaccounted for. This means that only 46% of the sailors made it home, and at least 22% died. Alauda Equiano, a slave who managed to gain his freedom and who wrote the tract Wesley mentioned to Wilberforce, describes his encounter with such a ship. Quote, I was soon put down under the decks, and there I received such a salutation in my nostrils as I had never experienced in my life. So that with the loathsomeness of the stench and crying together, I became so sick and low that I was not able to eat, nor had I the least desire to taste anything. I now wish for the last friend, death, to relieve me. But soon, to my grief, two of the white men offered me eatables, and on my refusing to eat, one of them held me fast by the hands and laid me across, I think, the windlass and tied my feet, while the other flogged me severely. Close quote. Such horrors were only a fraction of the nightmare experiences that began for an African, male or female, adult or young, snatched by warring, man-stealing tribes to be sold on to white traders. By the end of the 18th century, most of civilized Western Europe, in particular the Portuguese, French, Spanish, Dutch and English, manned their colonial plantations with slave labor. Even from a 2007 perspective, it is difficult to come to terms with the sheer scale of Britain's villainous involvement in the slave trade. It is true, as Professor C.R. Fay wrote, that England's only excuse can be that she did not begin it and was the first to end it, but this does not erase the crime. Nor will guilt be removed by Western leaders indulging in gesture politics in Africa or church leaders pronouncing retroactive apologies. Forgiveness just does not work that way. Sin is only removed when in this life someone turns personally to Jesus Christ as Saviour. Restitution should be made where possible, but sometimes the situation is too tangled even for that. Consider secondly the difficulties of abolition. Slavery is a classic example of institutionalized sin. And the Clapham Group reasoned it could only be ended in a two-step process. They determined, firstly, upon cutting off the transporting of slaves to plantations, abolition of the trade was to be the means to the greater end of full slave emancipation. But the first stage alone faced them with huge difficulties. What were these difficulties? Firstly, England was insensitive to the lot of slaves. By 1740, Britain was in a condition of spiritual destitution. The Church had squandered the spiritual heritage of the Reformation and Puritan eras. The nation's morals were in an appalling state. The aristocracy was cultured, magnificent, and dissolute. The poor, downtrodden, illiterate, sodden with gin, given over to vicious living and brutal pastimes. Even by 1790, some 50 years after the evangelical awakening, drunkenness, gambling, political corruption, and kidnapping, crimping or the press gang, prostitution and child neglect were widespread. Even 40 years after the Gin Act of 1751, 1/8 of the deaths of London adults were said to be through drinking excess spirits. This low state of things manifested itself in British law. Although the abolitionist Granville Sharp had won an important legal victory in 1772, he lost a more notorious case 9 years later. In 1772, he successfully pleaded the cause of runaway Negro slave James Somerset, so ably that Lord Chief Justice Mansfield was reluctantly persuaded to pronounce that, as soon as any slave sets his foot on English ground, he becomes free. But in 1781, Sharp failed to get the captain of the slave ship Zong prosecuted for murder. A Lauda Equiano had drawn Sharp's attention to this incident. The Zong's captain had ordered that 133 sickly slaves be thrown overboard. His reasons were logical. Living slaves, unlike dead ones, were counted as cargo, and their loss compensatable by insurers. In this case, £30 per slave, or £2,000 per slave in today's money. But there would be no reimbursement if they died while on board ship. So the captain acted accordingly. In the ensuing legal wrangle between the insurers and ship's owners, Lord Mansfield's statement said it all, that there is, quote, no doubt that, though it shocks one very much, the case was the same as if horses had been thrown overboard. Secondly, the second difficulty, many British people accepted an Enlightenment view of ethnicity. Although it was half a century before Darwin, some Enlightenment philosophers had embraced a fashionable theory of human origins called polygenesis. This stated that different human races were separately created and not descended from one couple. In an essay on the Negro, Voltaire said, "The Negro race is a species of men as different from ours as the breed of spaniels is from that of greyhounds. If their understanding is not of a different nature from ours, it is at least greatly inferior. They are not capable of any great application or association of ideas." Immanuel Kant wrote in 1755, "The Negroes of Africa have by nature no feeling that rises above the trifling." So fundamental is the difference between those two races of men, he means white and blacks, it appears to be as great in regard to mental capacities as in colour. Little wonder that blacks were so easily consigned to slavery, although it should be noted that there were some white slaves as well. The third difficulty, many British people had no first-hand knowledge of slavery in the raw. Out of sight was out of mind. Several prominent abolitionists only became involved after encountering slavery first-hand. The young lawyer, James Stephen, while in Barbados, witnessed a miscarriage of justice against four slaves, culminating in two of them being sentenced to be roasted alive. Zachary McCauley, at the age of 17, worked as an overseer in a Jamaican sugar estate. He returned to England sickened by the violence and, in his own words, nearly callous and indifferent to it. But shortly afterwards was converted to Christ through the influence of his brother-in-law, Thomas Babington. Thomas Clarkson was a 25-year-old Cambridge University divinity student competing for a literary prize in 1785. He was set an essay by Vice Chancellor Dr. Peter Peckard entitled, "Is It Lawful to Slave the Unconsenting?" Peckard had been alerted to the subject through reading Granville Sharp's report of the Zong debacle. But the young Clarkson was ignorant on the subject and decided to research it thoroughly. The more he learned, the more appalled he became. He found himself, quote, overwhelmed with horror. He wrote, "In the daytime I was uneasy, in the night I had little rest." He won the prize, but that was now unimportant. He rode back to London, meditating on the horrors of slavery. While resting his horse at Wade's Mill in Hertfordshire, a thought came into my mind that if the contents of the essay were true, it was time some person should see these calamities to their end. Fourth difficulty. The slave trade was protected by powerful vested interests. Slavery was the economic powerhouse of the West India planters, rich dynastic families with large Caribbean sugar estates. About two-thirds were non-resident, living in wealthy English properties and employing salaried managers to look after their plantations. They were well represented in Parliament, especially the Lords. They comprised many peers and members of the aristocracy and exercised profound political and economic influence at home and abroad. Not surprisingly, they took exception to interference with their property rights. Also, rooting for the status quo was the Church of England's Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts. This body's governing council included the Regius Professors of Divinity at Oxford and Cambridge and the Archbishop of Canterbury. It was the absentee owner of the Codrington estate in Barbados, a 710-acre sugar plantation with more than 200 slaves. Fifthly, the British establishment was reactionary. This included the royal family and especially the Duke of Clarence, third son of George III and later King William IV. The powers that be viewed the slave trade as integral to the economic well-being and security of Britain. They believed slave ships were nurseries for seamen who would one day fight the French. As late as 1807, Admiral Jarvis, who was Lord Nelson's superior, declared that abolition would ruin the British Navy. Such conservatism was strongly reinforced by fear. The French Revolution had begun in 1789. Only 4 years later, King Louis XVI, Queen Mary Antoinette, and the French aristocracy were led to the guillotine in an egalitarian revolution that viewed neither nobility nor church as sacred. Liberty, freedom, and brotherhood were dangerous exports, as Thomas Paine's Rights of Man proved. A program to relieve slaves was tantamount to sedition. There was fear that talk of improving the slaves' lot would incite revolt. This was understandable in the light of sporadic slave uprisings. In August 1792, there was a large uprising of slaves on the French island of St. Dominique, which led to the massacre of hundreds of white settlers and the emergence of Haiti as a free black nation in 1804. We now turn to the parliamentary battles. However, the early English abolitionists had set their course. On 17th of June 1783, the London yearly meeting of Quakers presented to Parliament the first ever petition against the slave trade. It was signed by 273 Quakers. In 1787, a 12-member committee for the abolition of the slave trade, or just Committee for Abolition, was established in London. Nine of its members were Quakers. The other three, including Granville Sharp and Thomas Clarkson, were Anglicans. In 1788, as a result of abolitionist pressure, the Privy Council instructed its Committee on Trade and Plantations to begin an inquiry into the slave trade. The committee heard both sides of the case. Among the pro-slavers was Admiral Lord Rodney, who declared that he had never seen a Negro flogged half as severely as an English schoolboy. Another witness swore that slaves were so relieved at escaping Africa's barbarism that, quote, 9 out of 10 rejoice at falling into our hands. Among anti-slavers testifying were Reverend James Ramsay, 14 years rector of St. Kitts, and now vicar of Teason, or spelt Teston, but pronounced Teason, Teason in Kent. Reverend John Newton, a former slave trader and rector of St. Mary Woolnoth in London, and Thomas Clarkson. James Ramsay was part of the Teason circle that included Elizabeth Bouverie, the evangelical comptroller of the Navy, Sir Charles Middleton, and his wife, Lady Margaret. Thomas Clarkson had been tireless in gathering his evidence. He had ridden 1,600 miles in 2 months, persuading witnesses to testify against the trade. Once hunting a potential witness, he found him on the 317th ship he visited. Clarkson often faced personal danger. On one occasion, he barely escaped with his life when a gang of rogues tried to hustle him over Liverpool Pierhead. But he was able to show the committee the paraphernalia of slavery: its thumbscrew, punishment collar, chains, shackles, knotted rope's end for beatings, and instrument for force feeding. The Committee for Abolition sent every MP a copy of John Newton's thoughts upon the African slave trade. Wilberforce's first common speech on the subject was delivered on the 12th of May 1789. It drew on Privy Council testimonies and lasted an eloquent 3.5 hours. Here is one brief snatch where he takes issue with the ludicrous testimony of a Mr. Norris of Liverpool. Quote, "Their apartments," says Mr. Norris, "are fitted up as much for their advantage in circumstances will admit. They have several meals a day, some of their own country provisions, with the best sources of African cookery, and by the way, a variety, another meal of pulse, etc., according to European taste. After breakfast, they have water to wash themselves, while their apartments are perfumed with frankincense and lime juice. Before dinner, they are amused after the manner of their country. The song and the dance are promoted." Wilberforce went on, "The pulse which Mr. Norris talks of are horse beans. Mr. Norris talks of frankincense and lime juice, when the surgeons tell you the slaves are stored so close that there is not room to tread among them, and when you have it in evidence from Sir George Young that even in a ship which wanted 200 of her complement, the stench was intolerable." "The song and the dance are promoted," says Mr. Norris. It had been more fair, perhaps, if he had explained that word, promoted. The truth is that for the sake of exercise, these miserable wretches, loaded with chains, oppressed with disease and wretchedness, are forced to dance by the terror of the lash, and sometimes by the actual use of it. As to their singing, what shall we say when we are told that their songs are songs of lamentation upon their departure?" He concluded his speech, "It will appear from everything which I have said that it is not regulation, it is not mere palliatives that can cure this enormous evil. Total abolition is the only possible cure for it. And, sir, when we think of eternity and the future consequences of all human conduct, what is there in this life that should make any man contradict the dictates of his conscience, the principles of justice, the laws of religion and of God? Sir, the nature and all the circumstances of this trade are now laid open to us, we can no longer plead ignorance. But the House of Commons did plead ignorance. It adjourned to gather its own evidence in spite of the Privy Council's work, and even though Wilberforce had been ably supported by Prime Minister William Pitt and opposition leader Charles Fox. The next full-scale Commons debate on the issue was not for 2 years, in April 1791, but things went no better then. The Attorney General for the Leeward Islands affirmed that Providence had always intended one set of men to be slaves of another. And Lieutenant Colonel Banastri Tarleton, MP for Liverpool, pilloried his opponents as religious fanatics. The abolition motion was defeated by 163 votes to 88. However, something unstoppable had been set in motion. The defeat served to stimulate the grassroots movement for abolition. Throughout the country, there were petitions to Parliament, sermons, pamphlets, treatises, newspaper articles and poems, including William Cowper's The Negro's Complaint. The defeat also impressed on Wilberforce and his associates that the only hope of persuading an obstinate Commons to back down on this issue was to convince it not only of the trade's immorality, but of its impolicy or its inexpediency. What was needed was further evidence-backed argument, demonstrating the high mortality among sailors manning the slave ships, the economic efficiencies of the Middle Passage, and the dangerous long-term implications of enslaving Africans. It was partly this urgent need for data that catalysed the gathering of the Clapham sect. The group had not begun the campaign, yet some of its members, its future members, were already heavily involved. From 1792, abolition became its most defining work, and Thomas Clarkson, while his health held out, remained an important interface between the group and abolitionists elsewhere. Opposition to the slave trade demonstrated what the Claphamites' heartbeat was, a deep commitment to practical Christianity, to good works springing from vital evangelical religion. This was their motivation for patronising so many benevolent and Christian causes, and particularly abolition and the opening of British India to Christian mission. The group's precursors were Reverend Henry Venn, from 1754 to 1759, the evangelical curate of Clapham Parish Church, and later the vicar of Huddersfield, and John Thornton, a wealthy evangelical living at Clapham. During the 1780s, Wilberforce regularly stayed with John Thornton and became friendly with his youngest son, Henry. This was to be a key friendship. John Thornton was half-brother to William Wilberforce's Aunt Hannah. Hannah and her husband had brought vital Methodist influences to bear on Wilberforce as a 9-year-old boy. This had upset Wilberforce's immediate family. If Billy turns Methodist, he shall not have a sixpence of mine, his grandfather had declared, and they promptly took the lad back home to Hull. Henry Thornton was central to the Clapham group, and according to Professor John Wolfe, in his valuable Oxford Dictionary of National Biography article on the Clapham sect, consciously gathered it at Clapham for its philanthropic works. In 1792, Henry Thornton purchased a house called Battersea Rise on the west side of Clapham Common. In the same year, he made it possible for Reverend John Venn to succeed his father at Clapham Parish Church, and he invited Wilberforce to share Battersea Rise with him. There, Wilberforce lived until Henry Thornton's marriage to Marianne Sykes in 1796. Henry Thornton built two more houses in the grounds of Battersea Rise, which he let to evangelicals Charles Grant and Edward Elliot. Grant was a leading director in the East India Company. Elliot was brother-in-law to William Pitt. It was Pitt who designed the group's main meeting place at Clapham, the Oval Library at Battersea Rise. In 1797, Wilberforce followed Henry Thornton's domestic example and married Barbara Schooner. Edward Elliot succumbed to serious illness and died later that year. The Wilberforces moved into his house, Broomfield. So the inner circle of the Clapham Group consisted of the Grants, until they removed in 1802 to London, the Thorntons and the Wilberforces, with the Venns at the rectory, all living in close friendship and worshipping together in nearby Clapham Church. This circle was soon extended by arrivals to other houses around Clapham Common, James Stephen, and in 1802 Zachary Macaulay and John Shaw, later Lord Tynemouth. Shaw had been Governor General of India from 1793 to 1798. Granville Sharp also visited from nearby Fulham. He was a self-taught genius who, quote, studied Hebrew to confute a Jew and Greek to confute a Socinian, and to such effect that he made original contributions to the study of both languages, close quote. There was input from Charles Simeon and Isaac Milner from Cambridge. The latter had been used in Wilberforce's conversion during the mid-1780s. Another regular visitor was Hannah Moore. She was a member of the Blue Stocking Circle and a well-known literary figure and playwright. During the 1780s, she became an evangelical Christian, particularly through reading John Newton's Cardiphonia, or The Utterance of the Heart. She resided in the Mendips with her four sisters. The sarcastic William Cobbett called her the old bishop in petticoats. There were other places to meet at as well as Clapham. There was the home of the Mrs. Moore, Bath when Wilberforce was ill, Thomas Babington's Rothley Temple in Leicestershire, and Reverend Thomas Gisborne's Yoxall Lodge in Staffordshire. Babington, Gisborne and Wilberforce were close student friends at Cambridge. In October 1790, the three had worked together non-stop at Yoxall Lodge as they trawled over 1,400 pages of Privy Council evidence to furnish Wilberforce with detailed arguments ready for the 1791 parliamentary debate. However, apart from Lord Tynemouth, no member of the inner Clapham group had held high office, although Babington, Grant, Stephen, Thornton and Wilberforce were MPs, and Charles Grant became deputy chairman and then chairman of the East India Company. The group's effectiveness, humanly speaking, was in its own fraternity and its natural abilities and extensive connections. Today is called networking. In Parliament, the Claphamites spearheaded a larger group of concerned MPs that included Henry Banks and Sir Charles Middleton. They worked with important figures like Jeremy Bentham, Henry Broome, Lord Castlereagh, Cornwallis, Lord Henry Dundas, William Pitt and Wellington. These connections were important after 1807, when, urged on by the Claphamites, the British government enforced the abolition of the trade within its own jurisdiction and sought to extend it to other European powers. By April 1792, the House of Commons had received an unprecedented 519 petitions. The one from Edinburgh stretched the length of the Commons floor. A sugar boycott had also been started. Thomas Clarkson observed there was no town where some were not boycotting sugar and rum, and estimated that up to 300,000 Britons had stopped using West Indian sugar. With the help of the Abolition Committee, Clarkson also prepared a diagram of the slave ship Brooks that displayed visually how tightly packed slaves were on slave ships. This visual aid was widely circulated and, in a non-image age, proved a sensation. However, the Clapham sect's battle in Parliament proved much harder. The West India lobby realised that its arguments were being trumped and were happy in the Commons debate of 1792 to accept Henry Dundas's suggestion that abolition be gradual, the date being fixed as 4 years later in 1796. However, in the West Indians' mind, postponement was indefinite. But it would not be 1796. News of the French Revolution, followed by outbreak of an Anglo-French war, proved highly unfavourable to abolitionists. The 10 years from 1794 to 1804 brought one parliamentary defeat after another for Wilberforce and his allies. Sometimes they seem closer. In 1794, Wilberforce managed to carry a Commons Bill preventing the supply of slaves to foreign nations, but it was thrown out by the Lords. Then, in January 1796, he lost the third reading of a Commons Bill by only 74 votes to 70, having won the first two readings. Half a dozen abolitionist MPs had missed the vital vote. Confident of victory, they had gone to see a new opera from Italy. By 1797, victory seemed far off. William Pitt, although a friend of Wilberforce and hitherto zealous in the cause, was fatigued and unwell. He was distracted by war with France and the national debt and could no longer be counted on to make abolition a priority. In 1800, the war and bad harvest brought widespread distress, and Wilberforce decided that it was, quote, prudent to forbear bringing forward the question in any form before Parliament. Nor did he do so between 1801 and 1803. However, the Clapham Group continued to meet and plan, usually at Wilberforce's London home at Old Palace Yard, Westminster. The national mood was beginning to change. No longer was abolition synonymous with sedition. Also, the 1801 Act of Union between England and Ireland brought 100 Irish members into Parliament with no instinctive sympathy for the trade. On the 30th of May, 1804, Wilberforce introduced an abolition bill to the Commons for the first time since 1799. He won by 124 to 49 votes, but the bill was stalled in the Lords. The Lord Privy Seal, invoking the wisdom of our ancestors, boasted that there was one house at any rate that looked after the interests of the merchants and colonists. Wilberforce recognised that an immediate Lord's vote would be fatal and agreed that it should not come to a division. The Lords adjourned until the next session and then threw it out. In January 1806, William Pitt died and a new government was formed. This change was decisively advantageous for the Clapham Group. Also, Britain's victories against France in the West Indies had prepared the ground for the Foreign Slave Trade Act. This act, in the interests of throttling French trade, prohibited British subjects from transporting slaves into captured colonies or foreign territories. It was now only a step away for Parliament to agree that the slave trade to British colonies be stopped as well. Lord Grenville, the new Prime Minister, was a convinced abolitionist, as was Charles Fox, his Foreign Secretary. Both men wanted to distinguish their new administration by enacting immediate abolition. There was a majority of abolitionists in the cabinet, and Grenville decided on a new tack. For the first time, he introduced the bill in the Lords before the Commons. In the Lords, the West India lobby put up a heated rearguard action. The Earl of Westmoreland declared that, though the Presbyterian and the prelate, the Methodist and the field preacher, the Jacobin and the murderer, combined against British property, he at least would not yield. However, in February 1807, the bill won through, and a few weeks later passed the Commons by an overwhelming majority of 283 to 16. During the debate, Solicitor General Romilly contrasted Bonaparte and Wilberforce as they retired for their night's rest. Bonaparte in pomp and power at the summit of ambition, yet with sleep tormented by the blood he spilt and the oppressions he had committed. And Wilberforce returning home into the bosom of his happy and delighted family to lie down in pure and perfect felicity, conscious of having preserved so many millions of his fellow creatures. As the House rose to a man to cheer Wilberforce, he sat with his head bowed and tears streaming down his face. On the 25th of March 1807, the Act for the Abolition of the Slave Trade received the royal assent. It would be many years before the trade was totally suppressed, and it would be 27 years before slaves in Britain's colonies were declared free, but that is another story. I'd like now to just assess something of Wilberforce's contribution in relation to the rest of the Clapham group. The point is that Clapham was teamwork, and it wasn't all Wilberforce. There has been a marked tendency during this commemorative year to overdo the role of William Wilberforce. His political prominence, winsome personality, and evangelical leadership, aided by an extensive bibliography, have understandably focused much interest on his role. But we must remember that he was just one member of the Clapham group. The campaign succeeded above all because of teamwork. All the Claphamites helped assimilate the vital evidence for Parliament and were lobbying for the cause. All were involved in persuading the nation. Without Clarkson's labours, Henry Thornton's wealth and astuteness, Zachary Macaulay's imperturbable courage and intellectual vigour, Thomas Babington's personal care of Wilberforce and Macaulay, James Stephen's legal acumen, and indeed each member's contribution, the group would not have succeeded. Nor was the campaign just a matter of words. In 1791, the year that Wilberforce lost his first Commons motion, Wilberforce, Granville Sharp, Henry Thornton, Lord Tynemouth, Charles Grant, Thomas Babington, and others launched the Sierra Leone Company. More than Wilberforce was needed for this. The company's proximate aim was to establish a colony for former slaves in Sierra Leone, and thereby demonstrate that Africa need not be a gigantic slave farm. Its ultimate aim was to show that Africa's natives could be civilized Christians, effective in agriculture and commerce, and so hasten the end of slavery as an institution. The Sierra Leone Company directors proved far too optimistic about the prospects, but they supported the project through thick and thin, and in 1808 it became Britain's first crown colony in Africa. Most of the credit for the project's survival in its earliest vulnerable stage belongs to Zachary Macaulay, one of the great unsung heroes of the abolitionist movement. He went out to be deputy governor of Sierra Leone in January 1793 and became governor in 1794 at the age of 26 years. His energy was astonishing. Somewhat dour, but deeply spiritual, he had a phenomenal memory. And like a latter-day Nehemiah, ran the settlement single-handedly. He dealt with everything from neighbouring slave traders to rebellious settlers to fractious missionaries to an utterly devastating attack by the French. When he returned worn out to England 6 years later, it was entirely in character that he chose to travel home in a slave ship via the West Indies to gather more data about the trade. In England, he recovered his health and made further vital contribution to the causes of abolition and emancipation. In 1799, he married Selina Mills, a protege of Hannah Moore, after a courtship that reads like the plot of a novel from a young contemporary author called Jane Austen. Zachary and Selina's firstborn was Thomas Babington Macaulay. Thomas later became the great historian Lord Macaulay. He was a highly precocious and well-read four-year-old child. One day his father took him to Strawberry Hill to meet Lady Waldegrave, a relative of Horace Walpole. During the visit, a servant spilled some hot coffee over the boy's legs. A concerned Lady Waldegrave fussed over the distressed child and after a few minutes asked him how he felt. He looked up at her and replied, "Thank you, madam, the agony is abated." So it wasn't all Wilberforce, but it wasn't without Wilberforce. However, although Clapham was about teamwork, Wilberforce's contribution should not be underestimated. He was an eloquent and engaging parliamentary speaker and provided a quality of inspiration and friendship vital for the Claphamites. He was a small man of slight frame, with a melodious voice and a heart full of praise to God. all soul and no body was how someone described him. He showed an engaging, and to his friends at least, a maddening accessibility to the streams of people soliciting his help. He was highly sociable, and conversation poured out of him, but it was hard to keep his mind on one subject. Something of his unique character emerges in this later account of family prayers in Wilberforce's household, written by Marion Thornton, Henry's oldest daughter and an acute observer. Quote, "By degrees, the family comes down to the entrance hall where the psalmody goes on. First one joins in and then another. Lizzie calling out, 'Don't go near Mama, she sings so dreadfully out of tune, dear.' And William, 'Don't look at Papa, William Wilberforce, he does make dreadful faces.' So he does, waving his arms about and occasionally pulling the leaves off the geraniums and smelling them, singing out louder and louder in a tone of hilarity, 'Trust him, praise him, trust him, praise him, praise him evermore.' Sometimes he exclaims, 'Astonishing, how very affecting. Only think of Abraham, a fine old man, just a kind of man one should naturally pull one's hat to, with long grey hairs and looking like an aloe. But you don't know what an aloe is, perhaps. It's a tree, no, a plant, which flowers.' And he wanders off into a dissertation about plants and flowers." Who then ended the slave trade? Perhaps this seems an odd question to ask, but the year 2007 has brought many misleading answers, with the Clapham sect seldom mentioned. There are three answers, each, I believe, correct at their own level. Firstly, Christians, or those deeply influenced by Christianity, were responsible. Some have portrayed 18th century abolitionism as a proto-liberation movement for blacks, centred on the lights of a louder Equiano. But Africans did not abolish the trade. They were either its helpless victims or co-perpetrators. Muslims and animists joined with white slavers to sell their countrymen into oblivion. Nor, as this paper has sought to show, did any one notable individual abolish it. 5 years after the death of William Wilberforce in 1833, two of his high church sons, Samuel and Robert, published a long account of their father's life. In this, they deliberately downplayed the contribution of Thomas Clarkson. This was foolish. Clarkson and Wilberforce were vital to each other and the cause as a whole. Wilberforce was clear that Clarkson, quote, "took up the cause before him," and Clarkson's words speak for themselves. "I certainly do not think that Mr. Wilberforce could have got on as he did without my aid and that of the committee, but neither could the committee have got on without Mr. Wilberforce and myself. Nor could I have worked to the effect attributed to me without Mr. Wilberforce and the committee." The point is that both men were Christians and driven by Christian motivation. So were nearly all the Clapham group and many other abolitionists. Clarkson, although admittedly half a Quaker, was a Christian believer. Moments before dying, looking up to heaven, his last recorded words were, "Come, come, come, my beloved." The movement was rooted in Christian thinking. Its followers embraced the brotherhood of man as made in the image of God. Its logo, devised by Josiah Wedgwood, was a manacled slave on his knees beseeching his captor, "Am I not a man and a brother?" Abolitionists, especially the Clapham sect, invoked the golden rule, "All things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them." They exhorted their hearers to imagine themselves as enslaved and so respond with Christian compassion. The second answer is that evangelicals were responsible. The Clapphamites were a highly talented group of people. Intermarriage between its families and with other leading British families led to a complex network of kinship. And Professor Noel Annan has demonstrated how this formed an intellectual aristocracy lasting well into the 20th century. But more than genius distinguished the first generation of Claphamites. Genius and independence of spirit can work in a very different direction. as demonstrated by another set, some of which were physical descendants of Clapham. I refer to the Bloomsbury sect and its alternative lifestyles. Bloomsbury, exemplified by E.M. Forster, John Maynard Keynes, Lytton Strachey, Vanessa Bell, Duncan Grant, Vita Sackville West and Virginia Woolf, rejected what Clapham stood for. Not a few of its members were homosexuals. What had begun to ebb away, even by the second generation of Clapham, was its vital evangelicalism. Fundamentally, the Claphamites opposed the slave trade because they did not want to see their fellow citizens engulfed by the judgment of God on their execrable villainy. They had a deep concern that Christ's gospel should prosper at home and abroad. Typical of this conviction is Zachary Macaulay's description of an encounter with a white slave trader in Sierra Leone. He promised to read a Bible if I send him one, which I certainly will do along with some tracts. He appeared at last much frightened and turned pale when I told him that last night's conversation might aggravate his punishment in the day of judgment. I have frequently seen such temporary convictions fastened on the mind of traders, but I never expect them to last. I should not wonder, however, if this man should read his Bible with attention. Well, the third and final answer to the question who was responsible is this: God was responsible. We started by quoting John Wesley. Consider this further intersection with him. An elderly John Wesley exhorted his Methodist preachers at Chester in 1786. Fellow labourers, wherever there is an open door, enter in and preach the gospel. If it be to two or three under a hedge or a tree, preach the gospel. Go out quickly into the streets and lanes of the city and bring in the poor, the maimed, the halt and the blind. And this was the way the primitive or early Methodists did. The primitive Methodist movement began in the opening years of the 19th century and in 1812 adopted these words of Wesley as its raison d'etre. This movement exemplified the forgotten revival period of 1790 to 1840, described by Reverend Paul Cook in his 1984 Westminster Conference paper. This movement was to become probably the most powerful converting movement Britain has ever known. The 1790s also brought many local revivals across the British Isles, such as those under the ministries of Reverend Thomas Charles in Barla and William Bramwell in West Yorkshire. During the very years that the Clapham sect was campaigning for abolition, vigorous spiritual awakenings were taking place across Britain, and thousands of ordinary people were being brought to repentance and faith in Christ. It was this wider movement that helped consolidate two convictions in the British population. First, that the democratic radicalism of Thomas Paine and the French Revolution was not an option for this country. And second, that enslaving other human beings is totally inconsistent with loving God and loving one's neighbour. While we can draw many lessons from this virtuous page of British history, such as how a small but united group of Christians can achieve much under God's blessing, or how the Lord honours persevering faith, or how it is possible for Christians to be salt and light without precipitating violent revolution, there is, I think, a more fundamental and abiding lesson. It was God who ended the slave trade. He worked at both ends. He worked through Clapham and other abolitionists. He worked by changing the whole outlook of a nation. It was as though he was putting on the record what happens to a community that gives itself over to the reign of his son. He will deliver the needy when he cries, the poor also, and him that has no helper. Is not this what our damaged world needs today above all else? The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ is not like the merciless deities of secularism and the myriad so-called other faiths that humanity has embraced since the fall of man. The Lord is full of compassion and tender pity. When the time is ripe, he will take decisive action on behalf of the defenceless, the widows, fatherless, and strangers. These events of 200 years ago remind us of a basic truth about God, that we so easily forget that God is love.